This is the TAM Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from Tant Talk Radio Network studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper an old friend who when I got his book the first time, I said, oh, this is a winner. And so I'm happy to welcome back Tim McGee. And the name of his book is Worthy McGuire. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Patsy. How are you?
Okay. Well, this is exciting because this is the 10th anniversary of Worthy McGuire. And we spoke about it first, I think maybe 5 years ago. And I was so impressed with the book. And I know I kept talking about it to people, and I was so happy when you decided to re-release it with some updates. So tell us about this process.
The re-release. So 10 years was, I first wrote the book 10 years ago. I probably thought it's a good idea to relaunch it. It's a good story. I still hear from people about it. And so what I did was the cover was I commissioned a very talented artist down in Florida named Daniela Mellon to do a watercolor of the cover, so it's a new cover, and I've also added some book club questions as well as an author's note kind of depicting what's happened in that 10 years since I first came up with the idea for Worthy McGuire.
Well, I think it's a wonderful book. And of course, it is a book that touched me in many ways because it is about the greatest generation. The World War II vets, like my father, who received a Silver Star a few days after D-Day, they never spoke about what they did. There were very few times that he ever mentioned it. The only time that he ever talked about it was when Marlene Dietrich's movie came on, because he was at the Battle of the Bulge, and Marlene Dietrich came there, and he had a chance to meet her. And that was like the only thing we knew about his whole World War II experience.
Yeah, it's just, I think that's very common. My father, he joined up when he graduated from high school. He left graduation literally and walked into the recruiting office and volunteered. And I remember several years after I was in college, he and I were talking about the difference. You know, I said, when I graduated high school, I was already kind of on track to go to college, and my biggest thing after graduating was, where's the next party? And for my dad, it was, all right, I'm joining the Army and going off to fight in this war. Now, he never went overseas. He was a drill sergeant in a camp down in Texas. And I didn't know any of this until after my father passed away. My grandmother actually handed me a stack of letters that he wrote to them while he was in the service. And it was very revealing about what he experienced as an instructor, and he felt very not shame, but he felt like he should have gone over with his company when they were called up. And he wrote to his parents and said he had letters from guys who were in Europe and fighting, and they were telling him, they said, do whatever you can not to come over, you know, you're stay there, this is not a good place. But just all of that kind of came to me, and I just thought it was an incredible story about that generation and the sacrifices that they made. And I wanted, and on a trip to France when I was, after a family wedding, I was over there with my wife and two of her partners in crime. We were traipsing all around Normandy, and the story kind of came into my head. At the time, I actually had been working on Durkin's Journey, which is a book I just published, and I put that aside to focus on Worthy McGuire. And when we came back from that trip, I spent probably the next year kind of framing out the story, as well as doing an intense amount of research around the D-Day invasion and the battle for Normandy, because I wanted to make sure, even though it's a fiction story, I wanted to get it right in terms of historical accuracy.
So explain the basic premise of the story. We have Worthy McGuire, a gruff guy. It's set in Detroit, which, of course, is a place where I also lived. So I love always when anybody mentions our sports teams.
Sadly.
Yeah, I know. Well, what can you do? You know, once a Tigers fan, you just can't change.
Yeah, but they've been rebuilding for about 40 years. So anyway, the story is Worthy McGuire is he's an octogenarian who decides he needs to fulfill a vow he made during the war, and it's important to him that he do this now. He's 88 years old, and he's tried a couple of times to do it earlier on, and you don't know who it's to, what it's about, just that this is really important to him, and he needs to go, and he recognizes very early on he can't do it on his own. His age is just working against him, so, and most of his friends have passed away, or they're not going to be able to help him, and he needs someone to help him get from Michigan over to Europe in order to fulfill this vow. And the only people he can count on are his family, and he's not very close to his family in the beginning of the story. It's a story about a dysfunctional family, and you know, it's ultimately a story about redemption and the importance of family. But it takes you through kind of the differences generationally. My dad was a greatest generation, and I didn't recognize, kind of growing up until much later, why it was so important, you know, in terms of his ideals and his ethics and morals, and how those differ from in many ways from baby boomers and generations after. Not that their differences are bad or wrong, it's just they differ. And so the story talks about how Worthy has to kind of face up to dealing with his family so that they can help him fulfill his vow.
And one of the things that I like so much about the story is really the family members. I thought that you have such a nice variety of family members and various dysfunctional levels, which made it interesting and very relatable. I think everybody reading this book, they'll say, yeah, this could be my family.
Yeah, I know this guy.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I guess one of the most common questions I get asked is, are the characters based on real people? And for the most part, the characters aren't, but they represent kind of different, you know, different types of people, except for Worthy. Worthy was based on someone that I knew. He was a dear friend of mine, and actually he was a friend of my father's. They actually met in medical school, and I used to vacation at his cottage up in Kingston in the summers, and when my father passed away, I reconnected with this guy and his wife, and my wife and I spent 10 years going up to see the cottage that I had gone to as a kid and spending time with him. And so he was that gruff curmudgeon with this really great dry sense of humor and a heart of gold. But the other characters were, I was trying to represent you know, the usual tensions that I sense in families in terms of generational gaps. And again, I'm not trying to point fingers and say, well, this one's right and this one's wrong. It's just they're different. And if you don't communicate or try and face up to these differences, it really can get out of control very quickly. And then that's kind of what happened with the Maguires. They just become this massive dysfunction.
And the nice thing about it, I think, when people read this story, whatever they see of themselves in the story, it might just spur them on to say, you know, let's get our act together. You know, in the end, it is family. And you've got them, and you might as well try to enjoy them.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's you know, when Worthy starts off on this trip, he reaches out to his two grandkids, and without giving the story away, but he needs a pack mule. He needs people to carry his suitcase and, you know, put his stuff in the overhead on the plane and drive a car. And he isn't looking for kind of any family reunion. He's thinking, I need you to get me here. But he recognizes he wasn't very close with his kids because of his really tough relationship with his son. So his grandkids were kind of distant with him. But he recognizes they have flaws, but you know what? They're pretty good people.
Yeah, that's it. There's redemption in there, and there's the ability to grow and to get better. And it's not true that people don't change, but it's also true that sometimes we don't recognize the goodness in people until they get a chance to show it.
Right. And that's the thing, is that I've had people say it's a very, interesting story, but do people change? And I think, you know, sometimes they do. I think sometimes they recognize, like you said, you're my family, you know, right or wrong, you're my family, let's try and make this work. And I think they recognize, as they're kind of going through this journey with Worthy, that why is it so important? They don't understand in the beginning what importance of this trip is, but then they recognize it, and it tells a lot about the Greatest Generation. That term that was, you know, that was first coined, I think, by Tom Brokaw. Just they made some pretty significant sacrifices, and I think it shows when they came home that they were, you know, it better be something that you know was worthwhile, and that's why people like my father were compassionate, yet they were also kind of very stoic and very, you know, I'm trying to.
Well, they were pragmatic. There was a problem. There was a global problem, and we went out there to try to make things better. I think one of the things that people will get from reading Worthy Maguire is that desire to maybe take a trip to France and go to Normandy, because it is a very moving experience. I did it several times, and each time I was so filled with emotion thinking about what happened on that day in June. I knew, you know, how my father, you know, stormed the beaches. I knew that 3 days later he did something that saved a lot of men's lives, and that's when he was awarded the Silver Star. But when you get there, it really is quite overwhelming, isn't it?
It is. And I think one of the things that struck me, or several things struck me, but one of the things that struck me when we got there, we joke about, you know, France and French people being kind of abrupt and whatnot. And I worked for a French company and experienced that in Paris. Yet when I went to Normandy and I was, you know, speaking English and the people, and also understood that my father had served, it was a very different experience. They were very welcoming and very, still 70 years later, very thankful for kind of what happened there, and also recognizing the importance of it. And the other emotion, I think, as you touched on, was when I went to the cemetery, the U.S. cemetery, just outside of Omaha Beach. And I didn't expect, you know, we were there with a bunch of tourists. It was in the summertime, so there was a lot of people. And you walk in this entrance, and then there's the museum, and then kind of walk a little bit further on the pathway, and you're hidden from the cemetery, and then you kind of turn around this bend, and there it is. And it goes on forever, it seems, with all of those headstones. And it just struck me. It was very emotional, like you said, thinking about what this represented. And this is just one of many cemeteries.
Well, now with the relaunch of the book, which I think was important that you do it, because one of the problems with, you know, you write a book and it's very nice, it goes on Amazon and it's there, but unless, you know, you call attention to it, unless you do something to make people aware of it, it's hard to get publicity. It's hard to get people to take another look. I think your additions to the book, particularly the book club questions, I think are really great. I hope that book clubs will get the book, use it as a tool, both to celebrate just great writing, but also to learn more about D-Day and about, as you have in there, more information. I think all of that additional material that you've provided for the reader is really great.
Oh, thank you very much. I agree with you in terms of trying to get it out there. I always thought it was a good story, and I always, in talking about kind of that generation, I always, they were unique, that greatest generation, and that was kind of the drive for me, was to write a story that kind of honored them. And so, you know, good to know that it's still a story that resonates.
And I think it'd be a wonderful, wonderful Father's Day gift. We all have family. I don't know what percentage of Americans, but we all have a relationship to people who served at that time and people who are serving today, our military, mm-hmm. that we want to honor. And this book, I think, will help people to understand a little bit about what it means to be a soldier, what it means to have suffered and lost a love, lost relationships. So what are you doing to really promote the book? What else are you doing? I know you've now got a website. What about your social media? How are you doing with that?
So it's an ongoing process. I'm the website was a very important step, and I have to thank you for your help on that, Patsy. And we're going to be trying to contact other like museums and whatnot, in some veterans organizations to get some more circulation out there in terms of talking about the book and getting the book in front of different people, different organizations. There's a nice ad coming out in Seniors Today in June, and also just kind of doing some local stuff up here in Maine, and when we were down in Florida, talking to libraries and other veterans organizations as well, to try and get some traction.
That's great. I'm glad you mentioned Seniors Today magazine. Seniors Today magazine is both online and a published magazine. It's a great resource for seniors and, well, for everybody. And your ad is going to appear in there, and it will be available on June 1st online. And all you have to do, people, go to Seniors Today, and you can read it there and sign up for their newsletters and their emails. Because it's a wonderful group, and I want to say again that I'm so happy that you decided to do this re-release, and I think it comes at a perfect time. D-Day is coming up, and I hope that you get out there and work with veterans groups and just get your name out there and really promote this book, because this is a book that you can promote every year at D-Day, and certainly year-round at all sorts of military and events and patriotic events, 4th of July parades, and all sorts of places. So I'm very happy, Tim, for you that you've done this. So your website, tell people your website and your social media links so they can find you.
Okay, so the website is timmcgeeauthor.com, and it's tim-mcgee-author.com, and Tim McGee Author on Facebook, as well as Twitter. I believe it's at tmanford27.
And the name of the book is Worthy McGuire, and so we got to talk to you about this book today, and what we'll do is sometime in July, perhaps you could come back, and we can talk about your new book, because that's quite a fascinating book, and that's set here, much of it is set right here in my area here, in the area where you come down when you're a snowbird, right here in Clearwater, Florida.
I would love to.
It will be lots of fun to talk about that book, because I always love books. Well, I love books where I've been to the places, and that's why I think the first thing with Worthy was Detroit. I got Detroit, and as long as I get Detroit in there, I'm always happy. So again, Tim McGee, I think you've done a terrific job, and I hope people get this book, Worthy McGuire. Check out Tim's website and his social media, and the book is available online, and it's not audible yet, is it?
Not yet. Working on that.
You're working on that too. Okay. All right. Again, thanks so much for being on Joy on Paper today. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Okay. And we're going to go to a book buzz with Bria Burton.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2021 release in print, ebook, and audiobook, Electric Midnight by Nathan Van Koops. This is book 2 in the Paradox PI series, and book 3 can't arrive quick enough, unless it could time travel. Now, let's download the book buzz. In the vein of futuristic noir detective stories with heavy doses of pulp, and where high-tech androids called synths roam, street-smart private detective Grayson Travers encounters a synth with a glitch, who winds up dead. Travers hits the streets of Port Nuongo, a Blade Runner-esque city on the Gulf of Mexico in Florida, following a lead from a coin the synth left behind. Soon, the TCID, a time travel authority, finds a reason to hassle Travers, despite his witty comebacks. With no reason to detain him, he's free for now, but his troubles with that organization escalate with every new piece of evidence he discovers, which includes a suspiciously convenient job offer from United Machine, the synth-making corporation who hires Travers to find the synth killer. When Travers needs a safe haven from all the heat and the underworld dregs that get their sights on him, his trusty time-traveling muscle car fitted with an AI named Waldo offers a ride to the Rose and Crown, a time-traveling inn that caters to clientele like Michelangelo and Samuel Clemens, aka Mark Twain. As Travers gets closer to discovering the truth, he realizes the killer might be closing in on him. This action-packed time travel mashup is a page-turning thrill ride with a likable hero, clever twists, and a richly imagined future. Author Nathan Van Koops lives in St. Petersburg, where he teaches writing and publishing classes with Keep St. Pete Lit, and has had a career in aviation for over 20 years. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar. at www.goehs.com. Go solar. Go savings. Go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Ed Hagem, the author of On the Road Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom. Hi, Ed.
Good morning, Patsy. How are you?
Okay, great. Well, you know, this is your third visit to Joy on Paper.
I can't believe it. You've got enough of me, I hope.
Well, you know, after the first time you were on, I knew you were a hit because by the time I got home from the studio, I already had emails from people saying, well, you didn't ask him enough questions. And so you were on, then I had you back a few weeks later because there were just more things I wanted to talk to you about. And I've been thinking about you a great deal. Recently, I've had quite a few books come to me of people who have been in foster care. And so, of course, I thought of you and I thought about the work that you're doing with foster care. And altogether, your entire life is such a testament to just getting out there and doing it and not feeling sorry for yourself, not dwelling on all the bad things that might have happened to you, but getting out there and making a difference in the world.
And never be a victim if you can help it. I mean, just go on. Find out what's next. Use the energy that you use in being a victim to move yourself forward. Because moving forward is difficult, too. If you use the energy, you know, I'm a victim. Woe is me. Somebody's done me in. Go on. And, a couple times in my life, I could have easily fought the person who put me down. Instead, I went on to the next, on to the next thing.
Exactly. As I said, my listeners know about you. I've often mentioned you when I'm talking about other books. I talk about somebody being an inspiration to others, and you have done that over the years.
Thank you so much, Pat. That's wonderful. Thank you.
It is really quite an amazing story. So we'll give a little background, and then I want to talk about current events, because one of the things that people said to me, well, he's accomplished so much, but can he give us details? How did he do it? So first, and especially now in this economic situation, you know, you were on the program. It was the 6th anniversary of Joy on Paper. That was back March 17th when the book came out, March 17th, 2021. And so I recently celebrated the 7th anniversary of Joy on Paper, which was rather surprising that I made it because during the pandemic, it was very difficult. It's been difficult to get sponsors. It's been difficult just to keep the show going. There was a time when I was taping actually at home, sitting next to my dishwasher. So
you don't give up either.
That's right, I don't. And I think that's the important thing. When I hear today, when I hear about so many young people who don't want to go back to the office, who don't want to, you know, put in the hours. It surprises me because I've worked all of my life since I was 7 years old and I got a paper route. I was the first girl to have a paper route in our town. And I've been working ever since, but I've been loving it.
The great satisfaction in working. I love my work. I love to work. I mean, there's nothing better than doing something, getting something done. I mean, that once you get that feeling, then you always want to work. And I, like you, I didn't have paper. I sold papers on the street corner in Los Angeles. It was a great experience. I still remember as a kid moving from corner to corner. The papers, by the way, were 1 and 2 cents then.
But we had fun doing it. You know,
oh, yeah, and I still have fun. I'm still the chairman of a company up in Boston. I still love work. And by the way, this book is now, it's a great experience working on this book. So, I mean, I think young people ought to recognize that that's what it's all about, is finding something you love to do and doing it.
Exactly. Because, of course, you've been in, I mean, you are like so famous in Wall Street. You've been with all the major companies. You've done so much. Think of you being interviewed by Anthony Scaramucci. That impresses me.
I don't know. I just go forward every day, and it's just fun talking to people like yourself and getting a feeling. I learn almost as much as you do and on anything we do, because I'm learning a lot about myself by people's questions and so forth. It's been a very good experience for me. So people ask me what's next, and I think it's the book. And I'll have another one coming out next year, and I've got a third one that's back in the process right now. So this is a whole new experience for me, and I've always been a private person, and going out in the public arena is a little scary, but it's sort of working out.
Well, I think you have that enthusiasm that people need. People need to hear that, yes, you know, you can overcome things and you can do things. In February, I had Eugenia Lovett West on my program. She's 99 years old. She celebrated her birthday on my program with the release of her new book about cybercrime. Now, if you can be 99 years old and still, you know, writing about a subject as difficult as cybercrime, you have a lot to look forward to, people. Don't give up the ship, because so many people are like, oh, you know, it's over when I'm 60, it's over. You know, no, life can just begin then. You just have to grab it.
And having something to do, you read the books, having something to do causes you to live longer. That's what, you know, everybody talks about diet and exercise. Having something to do is still number one. Getting up in the morning and having something really to do is very, very important to live a long and a long life. Because the books that have written at Harvard about this big study that went on for almost 90 years, they calculated the people that had something to do, physically to do, every morning that was worthwhile, lived longer than anybody else. And second of all, with relationships. And then came diet and exercise. You know? So that's why this book and you know, all my work, I mean, I still have gone to the stock market every day. You know, I have a bunch of groups of people I talk about the stock market. I have, you know, blogs of all kinds of geopolitical information coming in every day, because it's what keeps you alive, you know.
Okay, so let's take one step back, and we'll talk, because for some of my listeners who are just, you know, new to the program, they don't know about these years, the difficult years in the beginning of your life. What do you now, when you go out and you're going now around and you're going to be meeting people, what do you like to tell them about those years?
Well, I like to tell them that it was a very difficult period looking back on it. In fact, I had a great deal of difficulty talking about it at the beginning. And actually, my daughter, I couldn't write about it. My daughter actually wrote the first draft of my early life from the letters that my father had and the letters that I wrote him. I mean, I couldn't handle it. I used to sort of well up, but now that I've told the story enough times, it basically doesn't bother me anymore. And it's real. And what I like to tell people is that I had many disadvantages as a child. My father kidnapped me when I was 3. I lived in 5 foster homes. I lived in 2 orphanages and so on. But a lot of the disadvantages that occurred during that period turned out to be advantages in life. And that really gives me a message to people is that, you know, don't let your children have too easy a life. Make them uncomfortable. Have them work in the summertime. Have them do things, because it's important that they have problems. And early failure is a gift. I tell people there's only 2 things that can happen once you try something. One is success. The other is a learning experience. And you learn much more from your failures than your success. In my case, I learned much more from the trials that I had, the difficult families I lived with. You know, going from one school to the other, those gave me adaptability. I was able to adapt. In fact, later on in life, actually embrace change. I enjoy change. A lot of people have difficulty with change. But if you've gone from place to place as a child, you've learned to handle change. In addition, you know, it gave me perseverance. I pushed my way through. you know, a few times. If you don't make it, you keep going. You get success, a success syndrome. And the most important is you get self-reliance. You don't have to rely on anybody else. If you're in a childhood, you end up doing things yourself. I mean, in the book, it shows many cases I was all by myself. I mean, it is a little bit sad. You know, nobody came to my grammar school graduation. Nobody came to my high school graduation. Nobody came to my college graduation. But I got through those things. And so that, you know, what eventually you come up with is you're really grateful. I mean, one of my characteristics now is I'm really grateful. People say to me, you know, how are, because I'm 85 years old, how are you? You know, you like to give an organ symphony about all things that are wrong, but you just say, I'm grateful. And it's true.
Well, that's one of the things that was funny when I, after the first interview, I got home and people said, well, you gave the age wrong. He sounds too young. He sounds so vigorous. I said, yeah. I said, you know, he is. He's vigorous, and he's full of life, and he's full of joy, and he wants to do more and not sit back and just, you know, mope around. He wants to achieve things, and that comes through in your voice.
Thank you, because, you know, I got a letter the other day from somebody who heard one of my podcast, one of my interviews, and her mother wrote me a letter saying her daughter was going to go out and work. She didn't have any energy. And all of a sudden, after listening to me, she applied to college, and she's going to college in September. And she said, and the girl wrote me a letter thanking me. And, you know, that pays for everything you do. If you can change people's lives and get them motivated to do things, you know, you're really accomplishing something. And, you know, in later life, that's what you want to do. I mean, in my book, I talk about, you know, Scott Peck, when he talks about love. Love is giving to others. And, you know, if you have a chance to do that, you're very lucky. And this is what I'm doing now. Talking to people like you. This has been a whole new experience for me, but people like you have read my book, are interested in it. And people tell me a lot about themselves. I can actually write a book about what people have written me about themselves. And so that's kind of fun. So this is all fun, and I'm having a good time. And I'm doing, you know, it broadened me. I'm now the commencement speaker at a university. I just finished that. I'm going to be a commencement speaker at a high school in Greenwich, Connecticut in a couple of weeks. So all these things are opening up to me. And also things I didn't know about. There's an organization, I said, in Boston that just deals with foster kids. 75 foster kids in college in Boston. And I'm able to help that organization and help those kids, convincing them that, you know, they can get through. Because the biggest problem with most kids coming from orphanages or foster homes is that first year, you know, they funk out because it's social integration, not academic problems. And you got to convince them they got to power through it. That's been my message, you know.
And it is such an important message. As we look today at the just insane violence that's going on in the streets, we see all these young people who are really, they're lost, and they get involved in all of this criminal activity because they're just floundering.
Well, that's absolutely true. And that's one reason, one of my mini crusades is vocational education. You know, in Nantucket, we have a golf course, and we give out 2 scholarships to universities every year. And about 3 or 4 years ago, I went to the principal, and I asked the principal, how's it going? He says, great, we really appreciate it, but half the kids here don't go to college. So we started giving vocational scholarships. And we give out 7 vocational scholarships every year, and I'm on a crusade increase vocational education. Down here in the Keys, we've opened the Upper Keys Community College, training nurses, first responders, marine engineers, you know, safety officers, and so on. You know, kids can find something he or she wants to do. You've got to get the education to do it. And, you know, just for example, in Nantucket, we have a couple kids that wanted to be chefs. You go to Johnson Wells, it's $40,000 a year for 2 years. So we provide that scholarship for that student. And that's what I think we have to do more of. We have to have these kids that are in the streets and so forth, ask them what they want to do. They don't have to go to college. They can become, you know, my electrician makes a lot more than my doctor does. So, you know, and it's harder to get an appointment with the electrician than it is the doctor. So that's one of my crusades, and I'm hoping other people jump on the bandwagon and start to give kids education that allows them to get jobs. And there are plenty of jobs around today. So that's what, and once you get a job and you get, you know, you make money and you can spend it and you have a good time with it and you really feel good about yourself, then it's, you know, you're on your way. I see this happen to lots of kids. But it's really, it's hard work, and, you know, I can't do it all, and the people are now grabbing on to this thing and basically telling kids to let's get something to do. And if you find something to do, you're a pretty happy person.
And as you said, you can make really great money with incredible. Just had to hire a plumber, and believe me, that guy went away very happy.
And by the way, when he fixes something for you, he feels good about it. I'm an chemical engineer, so I'm kind of a plumber too. And when our plumber comes in, I sit down and talk to the guy. He's a happy man because every day he's going around and helping people and solving people's problems and charging them for it.
Getting paid for it. I think there's also a level that we have to respect people who are, you know, working like that, doing jobs that are necessary. We have to respect them because they want to learn. And it's just they learn at a different, you know, a different style than
different
going
style.
To...
And they, all these people have interests. They, you know, they can pursue interests. But they have to get something that where they're the postman. The gal who cleans our house is just terrific. You talk to be smart as a whip. But this is what she wants to do. And she really enjoys doing it. And, you know, she has a very good, nice business now. And she has a little girl. And then, you know, that's her life. Everybody, there's no right life. This idea that you have to go to spend 4 years in college is absolutely crazy. You know, you've got to find something. You have to exercise your passion. My four P's. Find your passion. Find something you really want to do that excites you and interests you. And then do it for a while. And then if that wears out, find something else. Because there's always something else for you to do. And you're right. You know, my driver in New York, get in the car, he's always listening to classical music. He knows more about classical music than I do.
Exactly. We have to admire people for their abilities, whatever they are. Now,
that's exactly.
Let's go back to this 4P philosophy of yours. Tell us what does that mean?
Well, what I try to do is start one step back. I divide life into four parts: self, family, work, and community. Community is giving back. And into those four buckets of life, as I call it, I pour the four P's. Find your passion. In other words, decide what really interests you, what turns you on. Find something to do, you know. And I use my own passions. When I was in high school, my passions were math and science, you know, baseball and basketball and girls. And that changed when I went to college. You know, the math and science became engineering. Baseball and basketball became, you know, basically first intramurals after my freshman year. And then I became involved in extracurricular activities. And what I found out, my real passion was putting people together to accomplish a task or solve a problem or produce a product and helping people to do more better than they thought they could. That was a real passion for me. And that basically led me into being a manager. I really wanted to manage people. And so that really worked out. And then find your principle. You have to have principles. You got to start early. And I was taught the principles by the nuns in the Catholic Church. You know, I learned the golden rule by the golden ruler. But all your life, you must collect principles that you will follow. You got to decide on which lines you won't cross. You know, in my case, I used to collect them and put them in a book. I actually hang them on my wall, being a manager. One of the principles I found out in management was you can accomplish almost anything if you don't care who gets the credit. In fact, later in my life, I started to deflect credit. Anytime someone tried to give me credit, I tried to say, that wasn't me, that was him or her or them. And try that sometime when someone says, boy, you've done a great job. You say, well, yeah, I did, but so-and-so really contributed a lot to that. So finding your principles. My biggest principle today is gratitude. I mean, I'm grateful. I'm really grateful. People ask me, you know, how are you? And I say, I'm grateful. Now, find your partner. Find someone to love. You know, find someone who you can share your life with. Find someone who will support you and you can support them. And my wife, Barbara, I've married for 56 years. You know, I love her more than yesterday, less than tomorrow. And without her, I wouldn't be where I am. I found that I'm only as good as the people I surround myself with. You take all these ideas, you put them into self, family, work, and then plan. The fourth P. I was at college a month or two back, and the guy said to me, well, you give me a lot of ideas, Ed. Give me one idea that I do right now. And I said, sit down and write down your plan. Write down what you want to think you want to do and how you think you might get there. Because it's going to change. And then when that turn in the road comes, if you've got a plan, it's going to be much easier to make that turn in the road. The turn in the road won't be the end of the road for you. And you have to keep changing that plan, just like you have to pay attention to the change in your passion, just like you have to keep adding to principles and also keep adding to the right partners. And if take each one of those things in your work life, all those things work. In your family life, it's the same way. and in your community life. You're giving back, the four P's. What's your real passion as far as your giving back is concerned? Mine was very simple. I wanted to give young people scholarships because that's what changed my life. That's been my passion, and I've given, I think I'm up to about 300 or 400 now scholarships I've given out. And in my will, I've left enough money so that Rochester, my scholarships will go from 10 kids to about 30 of them every year.
Well, this is what's important, that you have to treasure the people around you, the people who have helped you, and you certainly have done that with your family and your so many, many friends through all of the years in business, where you were always known for both exactly what you said, giving credit to other people and being available to help people.
Helping them do better than they thought they could.
Exactly.
Like that. If you feel that I'm going to make you better than you think you can, to exceed your expectations, you're a happy person, and you like to work for me, or work with me, you know, because you're saying, you know, you're out there to help me. And that's what I tried to convey to people, and that's why I think my company did well, because that was the message I got to everybody. Everybody should help everybody else be better. And what happens is, if you do that, you end up being better than you think you are. So, well, I used to have a meeting of my board. You know, I had 13 or 14 people on the board of the company. It's a private company. And we would have almost a Quaker meeting. We'd stand up and say, you know, I need some help. Who can help me? And then somebody say, I think I can help you. I'll fix that for you. And this way the company did pretty well over the 15 or 20 years we were involved.
Well, you know, I bet, a year, just over a year ago when we spoke, one of the questions people, you know, said, well, why didn't you ask him for financial advice? Why didn't you ask him what we should do with our stocks? He knows so much. And I bet you didn't think we would be in this position we are today.
No, I've been, you know, having been through these cycles before, I have gotten got a little bit uncomfortable almost in last fall. And I started to decrease my positions in markets and so forth. And I'm relatively, really mildly negative. You never can be too negative because the world doesn't come to an end very often. So getting too negative is not good. But I think right now we've got a number of problems which are going to take some period of time to solve. You know, the pandemic is essentially, from an economic point of view, still, you know, festering in China, and that's going to hurt the world economy. The war in the Ukraine is a difficult circumstance, and it's not going to be over in the short term. And inflation has picked up because we've printed a lot of money in the last 20 years, and interest rates are going up. So, you know, if I was someone, I would be having a little more cash. I would, have a fewer stocks than usual. And that's been my portfolio. And I'm doing okay right now, to tell you the truth. I mean, I still think there are attractive parts of the market. But you just have to be a little more cautious now than usual, because there are significant problems which are going to take some time to solve. And there are unknowns. I mean, I can't tell you when Mr. Putin is going to decide to give up the ghost and stop that war. Inflation is something that makes me very uncomfortable, because it's something we haven't. I lived through the inflation in the 70s when interest rates went to 20%. You know, people forget that. You know, that was a very difficult period for the market, and so we may have some of that coming back. And so just having it, sell a few things, get a little more cash, be a little more conservative in your investment. Don't speculate as much as you used to. But if you find something interesting that you think is a good idea, still, you can invest in it. I'm not asking anybody to go to Vermont and get into a bunker. And America still has the lead in the world. You know, we've slipped a little bit, but we're still the best place to be. We still have the best economy. We still have the best currency. You know, we're in a competition more so than ever before. But I'm convinced that and there's so many opportunities today. You know, for young people, the world is it's just open-ended. I mean, think about the mobile internet. Think about the social media, social networks. Think about nanoscience. Everything's being made smaller. Think about neuroscience. We're going to have to solve things like Alzheimer's. So the revolution's going on in all the areas: healthcare, finance, education. There's all places to really work. You know, AI, artificial intelligence.
And the key is. I think the key is exactly what we hear in your voice: enthusiasm. If you have enthusiasm, if you believe anything is possible. And I'm so very happy that, you know, I was able to have you back here again, because I know my listeners will, when I get home, I will have a whole bunch of emails from people saying, oh, wow, he sounds so good. He sounds so happy. He sounds so optimistic. He sounds so young. And I really do appreciate you, Ed Hajim.
You're good for me, too.
You're wonderful.
After I finish the calls with you, I always feel very good. I take an extra quick step when after I've been talking to you.
Oh, well, that's sweet. And I also enjoy. Thank you very much for the cup that you sent me. I love it.
Okay, you got that one. Okay.
Oh, yeah. I use it all the time. Well, I'm a coffee drinker. I drink like, you know, 5 cups a day. So I'm always using your cup. So
that's wonderful.
And I think of you, and I am inspired by you, as are my listeners. So I want to, again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. The name of the book is On the Road Less Traveled, An Unlikely Journey from the Orphanage to the Boardroom. It's by Ed Hajim. And you have a website you want people to go to. It's a nice website.
It's Ed Hajim. www.edhajim.com. That's it. Very simple.
Okay. Ed Hajim.
He's done a good job on the website, too. My publicist. So.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
If you like it, go to Amazon, give me a rating and a review, too. I appreciate that very much. My publisher will thank you.
Well, Ed, you are an inspiration to all of us, and I want to thank you again so much for being on Joy on Paper. You are always a joy. Ed Hajim.
And Patsy, the force is with you, I can tell it.
Okay, thank you so much, Ed.
Have a great day.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Remember, I hope that all of you will remember what I always tell you, that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. And you never know unless you start writing. So everybody, start writing, get out there, and you will be a guest here on Joy on Paper next year. You know, that's all it takes. It takes a year of hard work. And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. And he saluted me, and I saluted him, because I really should have been a general. And then I would have a wonderful general's pension. Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Anyway, everybody, take care. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.